Welcome to the Last Rush Hour podcast. I'm your host, Fred Pilot, author of the recently published ebook, Last Rush Hour, The Decentralization of Knowledge Work in the 21st Century. If you've ever wondered that someday soon you would no longer need to waste time commuting to and from the office and the rush hour would become a thing of the past, the ebook and this podcast are for you. Today, with modern information and communications technology, knowledge work, analyzing data, reading reports, writing and producing presentations, planning and strategizing, and collaborating with colleagues and clients can be done anywhere with a reliable internet connection and whenever one can think, communicate, and be creative and productive. Knowledge workers and their organizations have begun migrating out of the commute and office space. People are increasingly working somewhere all of the time in home offices or in their communities. Some organizations have gone fully virtual, operating without the major expense of dedicated office space. Each podcast will feature a conversation with a notable individual influencing and driving this major shift in how we work in the 21st century information economy. This episode's guest is Kate Lister. Kate Lister is president of Global Workplace Analytics. Global Workplace Analytics conducts independent research and consults on emerging workplace issues and opportunities, specializing in making the management case for workplace flexibility, well-being programs, mobile work, activity-based work settings, and other agile workplace strategies. It has built models to quantify the economic, societal, and economic benefits of alternative workplace strategies for the U.S., U.K., and Canada. Welcome to the podcast, Kate.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You've been doing this for a long time, haven't you? How many years has it been now?
I guess about 8 years.
8 years? Somehow I thought it was much longer.
Well, I've been an advocate of remote work for, well, let's see, been doing it for 25 years.
Okay. Yeah, I thought you went back. Looking back over the 25 years, what do you see as the big changes that have happened and how we do knowledge work, which the term I use for office work, but you know, Peter Drucker's definition of the knowledge worker, people that work with information and process information for a living. How have you seen that work environment evolve over the last 25 years of looking at it and working within it?
Well, it's kind of a two-part answer, because if I answer you in terms of how the work has changed, it's one answer. If I answer you in terms of how the workplace has changed, it's another answer. So let me deal with the first one. We now have the tools to work wherever and whenever we want. And we're doing that. I mean, you can see it. It's evident in airplanes and coffee shops, you know, wherever we are, standing in line at ball games, you know, we're working. Now the other part of that answer to that question is, how has the workplace changed? Unfortunately, not very much. There are some folks that have been in this the consulting for remote work for, well, since the mid-1970s. I think you probably are one among them, maybe not quite that long. And it's so funny that they're having the same conversations now that they were 3 decades, 4 decades ago, about why it's so important, about what all the benefits are. About what the resistance is, you know, all of those things. It really hasn't changed very much for the majority. Now, having said that, all of the studies globally show that people are not at their desk 60-70% of the time. So, you know, they've already left the building, right? Like Elvis. But the office environment in most places has not changed that much. Now, the leaders are doing something about that. They're saying, hey, wait, our places are, you know, basically empty. Let's make these places into, you know, what they should be to support the worker. And so what's happening is the office place is becoming the place for collaboration, and home office and third place and all of those other places that people work are becoming the place for concentration. And it's, everybody wants to make this polar, you know, we're never going to see our colleagues again. It's just not true. The best application of remote work is a mix. It's that we work based on what we're doing. We decide where we're going to work and how we're going to work.
So the work is redefining the traditional office. Then how we work is changing, but the office has pretty much stayed as it was 30 years ago?
It's evolving, as I said, for some of the leaders, particularly in the Fortune 1000. And I think a lot of this was driven by the recession. It was a cost saving. When they began to look around and began to see that their places were far underutilized, they said, hey, this is an opportunity to reduce our real estate costs. Before that, the motivations for this kind of remote work, mobile work, were more along the lines of doing the right thing, sustainability, attracting and retaining talent, flexibility, work-life balance, those kinds of things. And unfortunately, those are not very easy C-suite sales. saving money is. In fact, when we first got into this business, we build these ROI calculators and show businesses how much money they can save, both their themselves, their employees, and the environment. And it's like, interesting. We don't really care.
Well, that's real interesting because you're dealing with businesses that deal with numbers all the time. That's what they do. They watch the numbers, and you're making a numbers case to them, and they're not buying it. Why is that?
Well, it wasn't really a the C-suite wasn't involved, and that's where the real focus is on numbers. And so, it was always a real estate lead or an HR lead. Maybe IT was doing something about making files available remotely, but there was no concerted effort. And when it started to become about money, that allowed us to get the C-suite attention. When you can show them that they can save $10,000 per employee per year by allowing them to work remotely half time, then that, particularly during a recession, that really gets their attention. And that has, now the pendulum has begun to swing again back to using remote work as a attraction and retention and work-life balance tool, but they haven't forgotten the lesson of the saving money, and it's lofted the whole conversation to the executive level. And so it's become kind of a holistic strategy rather than a sort of a hunt and peck. Oh, I call it the solution to the problem du jour. If they've got a problem with turnover, oh, well, let's try this remote work thing. Or if they've got a problem with absenteeism, well, let's try this remote work thing. So it was really kind of a hunt and peck, but now it's become an overall strategic value to a company to pursue these remote work opportunities.
And this is, I think you brought this up in your work tech presentation. This is also a wellness and employee engagement issue, right?
Yeah, again, that, I'm opportunistic in terms of whatever sells this. And when I first started creating these calculators and these ROI models, we talked about absenteeism and we talked about turnover and we talked about, healthcare a little bit, but more in terms of how it affected absenteeism. Because we use an awful lot of data. We have a database of over 4,000 case studies, articles, news items, academic papers that feed the assumptions behind our ROI model. So if we say productivity is going to increase by 12.5%, that's because we've looked at dozens of studies that show that is what it increases. And we get that down to the industry and the geography level. So there just wasn't enough data on the wellness and well-being. How did it actually impact that? But that's changed a lot over the last few years. So we know, for example, that if your population, if you're 20% of your population smokes, then that's costing you X dollars in terms of healthcare absenteeism and presenteeism. So if you can reduce that smoking, and that was kind of a bad example. So let's look at stress, because we know that being able to have flexibility in your schedule is a great reduction in stress. Being able to work at home where, your loved ones are and having a better work-life balance reduces stress. And we know from the studies, the World Health Organization has defined that if you have an employee that is suffering from chronic stress, then they're costing you, I'm not sure the numbers, that I have to look, something like $3,000 to $4,000 per year, and that's per capita, so across the population. But much more for that person that's stressed. So if we can help them reduce their stress, then we can reduce the costs of healthcare, but that's just tiny, the healthcare bit. The real bit is presenteeism. And it's funny because that word has entirely different meanings in Europe as it does here. So let me define it. In the US, it's coming to work but not doing your best because you're not feeling well or because you're, you know, mentally not feeling well. In Europe, it means exactly the opposite. It's coming to work and really being there, being present. So it's actually one of the number one driver in the U.S. for actually in the world for driving healthcare programs, wellness programs. And so, you know, we know that people, 80% of the population wants to work remotely. It doesn't mean they want to all of the time. And they want to largely for these work-life balance reasons. So, you know, we actually did a, I don't know if you're familiar with the well-building certification. A company called Delos has created a certification and a process that, you know, if you do all of these improvements to your building, then, you know, we will bless it with this certification, and we'll come in and we'll check, you know, periodically to make sure that it's still a well building. And it has to do with the air, and it has to do with germs, and it has to do with work-life balance, a number of things. CBRE, the big real estate company, redid their headquarters in LA last year, and they were the first well-certified building. So we've been working with Delos to evaluate what is the ROI, but, you know, we're not going to know that for a long time, right? You know, you're not going to know whether people got sick less or, you know, or and even if you do a year from now, how do you really attribute it to that change? So we turned that on its head, you know, being a numbers nut. We turned that on its head and said, okay, well, what would it take to break even on an investment in your building for wellness and well-being and have it well certified? It turns out that if 1.1 person doesn't become chronically stressed per year, it's entirely paid for the changes, the money that you invested in this well building. If 0.5 people don't leave the company because of health issues, it's entirely paid. These are ors, not ands. If people don't lose 8 minutes of productivity a week because of the improvements you've made here, it entirely pays for the building. But if people don't lose 8 minutes of productivity a week, it equates to their entire annual office expense for a company. So think about that. There are these companies that are, they're, you know, putting in place these what they call benching or open seating, and, you know, everybody has to sit in one big room, and, you know, it's noisy and it's stressful and it's not good. And so if they lose 8 minutes a week because of all of these things, they've got to wear their headphones and everything, they've totally negated what they've done to this office. Everybody wants to focus on, you know, real estate, but it's such a small part of savings that companies can find in being more agile and creating workplaces and work practices that really support their people.
Well, it's an interesting take on it, because I know wellness is a huge interest with the ever rising healthcare costs. And we're still primarily an employer-sponsored healthcare system in the United States, anyway, for the working-age population. And they're very concerned about healthcare utilization, either whether they're paying for it as a self-insured company or through insurance. And this is interesting, because you seem to be arguing that the agile flexibility will enable less stress. And I know you didn't exactly say this, but you seem to be implying that there's going to be also more opportunity to engage in health-promoting behaviors that you may have not had if you're making the commute to the office Monday through Friday every day.
Yeah, I mean, that's a part of it. And again, I'm often not necessarily just talking about remote work. I'm also talking about changes to the office environment, although remote work is what offers the biggest work-life balance impact and the reduction in stress. But get this, everybody's worried about the healthcare costs, right? Companies spend an average of $16,000 a year per employee on healthcare costs. Only 17% of U.S. companies spend more than $150 a year on wellness and well-being per employee. Only 17%, $150 a year. Now, we have an ROI. There are enough studies to tell us that these programs do work. Nobody's questioning the $16,000 they spend a year on healthcare, but try to install a wellness or well-being program or remote work program that's going to improve well-being, and everybody wants to see the ROI of it. You know, it's just, it's very interesting, and they're all focused. It's just like the building. You know, the building is just the tip of the iceberg in terms of the cost of the employee, the, you know, how their occupancy cost. It's tiny, tiny, tiny compared to the value of that employee and keeping them healthy and keeping them engaged. And it's the same thing with healthcare. Healthcare is a teeny, 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 tiny part of the cost of poor health. The big cost is in that presenteeism. People who are depressed, for example, that depression has the highest per person cost for employer costs, and it's largely in presenteeism. People lose 40 days a year in presenteeism who are depressed. So, you know, what can we do in the office environment to help them? You know, is it lighting? Does that help? And, you know, forgive me, you know, you can't just tell a depressed person to be happier. I understand that. But there are things that you can do. There's research that shows that a healthier environment make people feel better. And when they're not worried about loved ones, when they're not worried about the leaving their elder at home, it really can contribute to a reduction in not chronic depression, but, you know, that occasional sadness that we sometimes get. 40 days a year. I mean, you know, it's almost a day a week that they're losing. And the numbers with, you know, obesity and stress and smoking and poor diet and inactivity, they all are staggering when you really look at what the presenteeism impact is. So forget the healthcare thing. I mean, it's minor.
Let's talk a little about the generational shift that's going on, excuse me, with millennials coming into the workforce in large numbers, and their expectations are different than the prior generations, specifically in terms of having to come into the office all the time and be there. They want the flexibility to be able to do their work wherever. Which leads me to my next question, which pertains to the state of California, because they're having the discussion within the HR circles there. How do we make the state an attractive employer for millennials? Because, as you know, the state's very focused on having a fixed office location, set schedule. You work 8 to 5 in the office. You did a study in, I think it was, 2011, that showed that the state could save something like, $9 billion if it even went to using the office maybe 2-3 days a week and having the staff work outside the office the rest of the time, and kind of got buried under. I mean, is that being reassessed now? All the, 4 years later now?
Yeah, don't get me started on the state of California.
I have to.
The state of California led the charge, you know, 3-4 decades ago. We were doing some really progressive things in remote work. I mean, we've got 3 or maybe 4 of the top worst commuter cities in the country.
Right.
4 out of 10.
Right.
4 out of the top 10. And, you know, we have these big transportation bills and budgets and everything else. And all they want to talk about is putting in new rail lines and big infrastructure projects. And just nobody is talking about, you know, this, well, how about if we just get people off the road? It's a lot. I mean, there is no cheaper, easier, quicker, more employee-friendly solution to traffic than remote work. And I don't know what it is about the state of California, and I'm talking about the public sector, not employers in California, that it's almost like it gets shoved under the rug. Oh, we don't want to talk about that stuff. In spite of the fact that we were later in it, you know, 3-4 decades ago. We did a similar study to one you were referring to for the state of Washington. And the governor issued an executive order calling for flexibility, more flexibility among the public sector workers because of the benefits that we showed to people, planet, and profit. So don't get me started on California. I don't know. And it's even within our, you know, the communities of California. We're in San Diego. And I can't get the SANDAG, the local government council, to think about, to focus on the impact that remote work could have on our traffic problems.
Well, I'm wondering if, though, yeah, it's certainly a a legitimate transportation demand reduction strategy, and that's certainly something that transportation planners look at. I wonder if the problem is that they don't really see it as work per se, telework. They just see it as, well, if you're not in the office, you can't be working. So it's reconceptualizing how we do knowledge work, basically. And I think maybe they can't make that conceptual leap. It's just too big of a jump for them.
Well, they're not unique in that. I mean, since Jack Nillis first invented the term telework back in the 70s and telecommuting, the biggest barrier to it has been, you know, troglodyte managers who feel that they need to see the backs of people's heads to think that to know that they're working, in spite of the fact that the largest viewership of crazy cat videos is during working hours. I mean, you don't really know when they're sitting there what they're doing. And as I said, they've already left the building. So, you know, you're already managing a remote workforce in terms of, you know, space utilization. They're not there. So they're already doing it, and they're just not willing to face up to the management practices that have to go along with managing remote workers. So, I mean, they're really not unique in that. And in some ways, I guess the public sector is a little bit more hierarchical and rigid in that way than the private sector, but not by much. I personally think that it's the transportation demand management, TDM, folks, you know, like to move dirt and play with trucks and build railroads and, you know, put in new high-speed rail lines. And that's what they think of as transportation. They don't think of the other side of it as, you know, non-transportation, looking at reducing the demand for travel.
Yeah, and using information and communications technology as infrastructure, just like roads and highways. I mean, they can transport work,
too. In fact, the term telework and telecommuting, when Jack Nillis first coined the phrases, he coined them because the original phrase was the transportation telecommunications trade-off, and he thought that was just a little too hard to roll off the tongue. But you know, that's it. It's and it was now, you know, telecommunications, you could replace it with information technology. We have the ability to work anywhere, so why are we still going to, you know, these big buildings and clogging up the highways and creating these heat islands in downtown areas that affect the climate and, you know, all of those bad things that go along with traffic? I mean, I'm a real traffic snob. We work at home, and let's see, we've got a 11-year-old car that has 60,000 miles on it. Our neighbors tease us because we get cobwebs from the car to the curb because we just don't use it very much.
Well, let's look ahead. Where do you think things are going to go over the next 20 years in terms of agile working, this larger trend we're discussing? What's going to happen with how we do knowledge work?
I don't think we're at the tipping point yet. You know, we've got to get enough people, enough employees demanding it. Right now, as I said, the driver is attracting talent. So if, you know, I can go to work for XYZ company and work remotely you know, a couple days a week, and I go to this other company and interview, and it's like, no, you have to be here 5 days a week, and I'm going to go for the remote work one.
Right, because there's a cost attached to that that's borne by the employee, right?
Yeah, we find that employees can save about between $3,000 and $11,000 a year. I know that's a big range, but if you're in New York, the savings are going to be a lot greater by working remotely. And that's a combination of the car costs, the you know, dry cleaning, shopping, meals out, all of that kind of thing. And so, you know, there is a cost factor. There's also some people that can, you know, move further away from their office and live in a more desirable area and maybe cheaper area if they're allowed to work remotely. But, you know, I don't see that happening all that much. But I think, you know, the millennials, they're demanding it. The baby boomers are demanding it too. You know, we're at a point where I don't care about the rat race. I don't care about climbing the ladder to success. You know, I want to do my work, and I want to, you know, I want to continue working. I want to continue working, you know, probably into my 70s. But I want to do it my way. So it's really all generations, and not just the millennials, and even the middle generation. You know, they've got their own reasons. They're raising families, and they, you know, they have an attitude of, you know, wanting to really be there with them. And you know, so I think that there's just so many drivers right now that you know, I'm hoping we're sort of approaching a perfect storm for this kind of thing. It's actually much more popular in Europe, and one of the trends that I'm seeing is that the European based companies that have U.S. affiliates are bringing that kind of attitude toward remote work as a good thing to the U.S.
Well, where do you when do you think we'll see the? I want to ask you to go out on a limb here a little bit, make a prediction. When do you think we'll see the last rush hour in the United States, UK, Canada? When do you think that's going to happen?
I've seen the reports that say we've already reached peak travel, but I'm not convinced. I think that we forgot to factor in that we had a recession, and I don't know about you, but I noticed that there were less people on the highway. So, you know, I'm going to go out on a limb. I think 2020. It seems like a long way away, but it's only 4 years now. I think we're going to be seeing at least a quarter, maybe a third of the population working remotely. But those working, our research shows that about 50% of the population is in a job right now that can be done remotely. And that's changing every year because more and more jobs are becoming information kinds of jobs. You know, if you factor that against the 80% that want to, it says about 40% of the population, 45% of the population is likely to be doing this.
So 2020, the rush hour may not be anything like it was in 2015, is what you're saying.
You know, you probably know more about this than I do, but it doesn't take a lot of getting a lot of traffic off the road. For every one car you get off the road, there's a 3 times reduction in traffic congestion. And you can see that on a Friday afternoon in the summer when, you know, people have left early and there's less traffic. You can see it sort of all during the summer vacation time. As I said, you saw it in the recession. It doesn't take a lot to reduce the traffic congestion.
Okay, well, I think we're almost out of time. I wanted to say thank you, Kate, for being on the program today, talking to Kate Lister, President of Global Workplace Analytics. Thank you very much. And Kate, we'll have your website linked up at the website, Last Rush Hour website.
Thank you. There's actually a calculator on the site where, you know, companies can determine what they could save through remote work as well as employees. But thanks for having me on the show.
Okay, thank you.